Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So look at that, two record days in a row on the Dow. Surely that's got to mean something, right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 6th of March. Glad you could be with us. We were met at the closing bell this afternoon by yet another record high on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, 14,296 to be precise, which does, I suppose, make you feel pretty good about things because, ow, Adrian Hill, did you just hit me?
I'm sorry, but you gotta mellow out with this stuff.
You can't
calm down.
You can't hit. And look, it's a record. A record is a record.
Yeah, it's not a record that means that much. Let me explain this to you, Kai.
All right.
And let me start with Kelley Business School professor Scott Smart.
Okay, but no more hitting.
Fair enough.
It's a rough indicator of the health of the market, but there are some problems with the Dow as such an indicator.
For one, the Dow is a very, very small sample. It's 30 companies.
Since it only looks at 30 stocks, there are obviously big portions of the market that the Dow doesn't monitor or doesn't capture.
Google isn't there. Apple isn't there. I could keep going for a long, long time. Campbell Harvey from Duke has another reason you might want to do a little less, gee whiz, the Dow is so amazing talk.
It is weighted in a very unusual way.
Unlike other indices where the weight is the stock price times the number of outstanding shares or the market cap, with the Dow,
The weight for each stock is essentially the stock price.
And to calculate the Dow, you pretty much need fourth grade math. David Blitzer from S&P Dow Jones Indices explains.
You take the price of each stock and add up those 30 numbers.
And then you divide them.
By a number called the divisor, which scales it or gets it to the right size.
When they replace a company on the Dow, they change the divisor to keep the Dow stable. Right now, it's about 0.13. And then that's it. You're done. That's the Dow. No complicated formula, no algorithms. No wonder more serious investors prefer the S&P 500. That's 500 large corporations. That's up, but not yet setting new records. Sakai, you might want to cool your heels just a little bit. But sorry again about the slap.
All right, but it hurt, you know. All right, moving on with the observation that this is S-Day plus five. Let's just call it squeeze, shall we? The slowly progressing impact of the budget cuts that are upon us. The FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, has told 200 or so small airports that in just a couple of months, they're probably going to have to shut down their control towers. They're not going to close LAX or LaGuardia, but that doesn't mean it's not going to hurt, from Washington Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Larry Bowron got an email last night from the FAA.
Says, dear airport sponsor.
That's Bowron. He's the transportation director in Battle Creek, Michigan.
We regret to inform you that in order to implement the budget sequestration that went into effect March 1, 2013, the FAA must make some critical decisions about funding.
The FAA has to cut $600 million from its budget, so the administration may close 238 control towers, including the one in Battle Creek, which is home to the Kellogg Company. Bowron says its executives use the airport. Company representatives weren't available for comment. No commercial carrier serves the airport, but Bowron says it's busy.
You know, you can have corporate jets coming in. You can have military airplanes coming in. It equates to a very complex operating environment.
I heard the same thing from Mark Nelson. He's the air traffic manager at the Sacramento Executive Airport, where, Nelson estimates, 270 aircraft take off and land every day.
Who's going to make the call on who turns where and who turns when?
That would be up to pilots themselves to decide. Even without the towers, planes would still be able to fly in and out. But Melissa Rudinger says these airports wouldn't be as safe or efficient. She's with the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association.
There are corporations and businesses that take advantage of operating in and out of these smaller airports.
She worries they'd move if control towers close. Larry Bowron says he'd like to tell the FAA about his airport's importance to Battle Creek, but he goes back to that email.
The FAA is unable to consider local community impact that does not affect the national interest.
Bowron has 1 week to make his case. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Mean old Adrian Hill notwithstanding, it was a generally upbeat day on Wall Street. No, she's really quite nice, actually. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For high school students getting ready to graduate and head off to college, March is a month filled with acronyms, abbreviations, and confusion. There's the FAFSA, something called the EFC, the PLUS, and SAR. Understanding and navigating the student aid alphabet is kind of a calculus problem in itself, really. So some parents are hiring private college aid planners to help paint the best financial picture possible, or worst picture, as the case may be. Jim Burris reports.
High school junior Kaya Williams is a teenager used to achieving her goals. An accomplished dancer and straight-A student, her next goal is to attend Atlanta's Spelman College, a historically black school for women. Getting in is the first step. Figuring out how to pay for it is the next.
If there is a college that's going to offer me a full ride outside of Georgia, I'll be completely fine with that. I just really have to research more.
That need for more research is why Kaya and Mother Erica ventured out on a stormy day to visit Karen Powell, a certified financial planner and a senior college funding consultant.
Thank you all. I know it's a miserable kind of day, and I'm glad that you moved forward and came over to meet with me.
As Erica sees it, her family has a problem.
We're squarely middle class.
She and her husband earn a good income, and that could hurt Kaya. She's paying her own way through school, but her parents' income will determine how much aid she gets.
Our reality is that estimated family contribution is hers, and that's a lot to put on an 18-year-old.
So mom is considering paying college planner Karen Powell as much as $2,500 to help Kaya take advantage of opportunities for scholarships and aid. So what will they get for that money? Powell says a comprehensive six-pronged approach that begins with beefing up academics. Since Kaya is already in good shape there, the next move is to scrutinize finances.
There's tax strategies and income shifting and asset shifting.
Take income shifting. If a family owns a business where the student works, for instance, Powell recommends raising the teenager's salary, then setting aside that money for school. That offers a tax savings because the student's tax bracket is lower than the parent's. Another way to shift income is to hit up the college fund ahead of time to buy things a student will need for school. That way, there's less cash in the bank, cash that could count against financial aid eligibility. Powell says it's not about gaming the system.
We especially looked for ways that they will not be disadvantaged by the way their either income or assets are being held.
Powell is upfront about her fees, which are priced a la carte, starting at a few hundred dollars. Other college planners aren't so transparent. Lynn O'Shaughnessy is the author of the book The College Solution. She says a lot of planners are really just insurance agents looking to sell you a policy.
And the problem is with these insurance guys, you know, they can tell prospective clients, oh, well, you know, I got a $15,000 scholarship for this family or $13,000 a year for that family, and it sounds all well and good, but the thing is, usually those families, they would have gotten that money anyway.
With in-state tuition averaging more than $22,000 a year and private schools almost double that, parents and prospective students are easy prey for unscrupulous college planners. Consumer advocates say avoid those who use the hard sell to get you to shell out cash for their products. And if you don't know whether something's legit, call your local college financial aid office. Its services are free. I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. The Hidden Side of Everything is what he does. Dubner, welcome back.
Hey, Kai, thanks for having me back.
All right, man.
You know, last month, you know, we New Yorkers lost a legend, former Congressman and Mayor Ed Koch.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Now, Koch was unique in a few ways, including the fact that he actively solicited feedback from the public.
Hmm. Just serendipitously, on one occasion, I said, I'm Ed Koch. I'm your congressman. How am I doing? People stopped. to tell me. And I knew I was onto something.
So, Kai, this got me to thinking about feedback generally.
Okay.
It strikes me that a lot of people say they want feedback, but I'm not so sure they really do, especially if there's a chance it'll be negative feedback.
Yeah, no, man. Who wants to be told they're doing something wrong? Forget it.
That's probably right. But the fact is that if you really want to get better at something, it's hard to do that without feedback, whether
yes.
it's, you know, your job or
yep.
sport or schoolwork. So I wanted to know the latest academic thinking on feedback.
All right, well, give it up. What'd you find?
Well, let's start with the fact that there are obviously at least two different kinds of feedback, right? Positive and negative.
Yep.
As it turns out, they each produce their own benefits. Positive feedback is really helpful when you're trying to increase someone's commitment. So let's say, you know, someone new to a job or a project.
Mm-hmm.
Here is Stacy Finkelstein, a Columbia management professor who's been studying feedback.
Okay.
For these people, positive feedback is most motivating. It's what signals that there's value to what they're doing, they like what they're doing, or that they might achieve their goal at some point.
But here's the thing, Kai. Once somebody really buys into that goal, positive feedback has diminishing returns.
Hmm.
So if you're looking for actual improvement, you've got to start going negative.
Wow.
Okay? Here is
really?
Heidi Grant Halverson. She's a psychologist also at Columbia.
This seems fraught.
Look, doling out negative feedback is not fun. It's embarrassing. You know, we feel terrible. We feel guilty. So we love hearing, hey, maybe I don't have to give negative feedback. Maybe I can just say positive things. And if I just keep saying positive things, then somehow this person will work to their fullest potential and everything will turn out fine. And that just turns out to not be the case.
Well, wait, how do you know that's not the case?
Okay, so I'll tell you about the research that Stacy Finkelstein and a co-author, Ayala Fishback at the University of Chicago did. They ran a series of experiments with people
okay.
in a variety of realms, some novices, some experts. And granted, these are only experiments, but this is the best they could do for now. And they wanted to see how different people handle feedback at different stages of their expertise. And the results argue quite strongly that novices really need the positive feedback, but that experts just start to tune it out. So here's Fishback.
The more a person is committed to a goal, the more negative compared with positive feedback will be efficient.
But Dubner, people are fragile, man. I mean, you don't want to hurt people's feelings. I come out of the studio and somebody says, man, that interview stunk. That hurts my feelings.
Well, I guess there are two ways to look at this. You can either look at trying to make people happy or trying to make people better. If you want to make people happy, you know, well, maybe. Look, if you don't want to get better, that's your prerogative, right? If
yeah.
you do, then it's critical feedback that's going to help get you there. Now, I'm not saying you should eliminate positive feedback or that you should, you know, deliver the negative feedback in a way that makes people weep.
Well, give me a for instance here, would you?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked, Kai. So, as you know, I'm a really big fan of Marketplace.
Yes, I appreciate
I think you
that.
Do a great job as a host.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah.
I would like to look at a couple recent examples of your work. I've noticed you're smooth as silk on most domestic matters, but I think that you might want to think about practicing your foreign pronunciations a bit more before you get on the air. Here, listen to this one,
all right.
Kai.
If you want to know where those reactors built like Fukushima, rather, that Alex mentioned.
You are so fired.
All right. We're going to turn off your microphone. We're done. Stephen Dunn.
Hang on. Okay. There's another.
No,
there's
the prospect of a 250,000 new Romanian Bulgarians. And Bulgarians.
What are Romanian Bulgarians?
You remember them? Yeah. And here's a little something else I think you could maybe improve on, Kai. This is interesting. This is kind of a trademark phrase of yours, I found.
A final thought on the way out, which goes like this. This final note on the way out in which Boris Johnson, the mayor of the City of London. This final note as we
You're
leave off today, the
yeah,
end of the beginning, perhaps. At the.
I hate you.
This final note on the way out today. We did a thing a couple of months ago.
You know what? This may well be your final note, pal.
Possibly, but before I go, let me just
There's
offer
more?
This constructive feedback.
Oh,
no, here's the thing. I have nothing against the final note or on the way out, but together, they're just redundant. So what about cutting one of them? And just think, Kai, just think of all the extra time you'll save over the course of a year, maybe enough time to actually run an extra couple of Freakonomics radio segments.
Or 5 minutes every 5 minutes every 2 weeks that we don't have to have you on. How about that? Would that be all right, too?
Please, no. Please have me
back. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is his website. We'll see you.
I hope
maybe.
So.
Maybe. I don't know.
Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace is co-produced by WNYC and is supported by Reputation.com, helping professionals and businesses look their best when people search for them online. Learn more at 1-800-REPUTATION.
Coming up, no, wait, straight ahead, the whys and wherefores of how things go viral.
Some of it is keeping up with the Joneses, talking about things that make us look good rather than bad, you know, smart and in the know rather than dumb and behind the times.
That's good. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 42 points today, 0.3%, ended at a record 14,296, as I said. The NASDAQ dropped a point, actually, closed barely changed, 3,222. The S&P 500 gained a point of 0.1%, 1541. Verifone, the maker of credit card terminals, is having a tough year but beat earnings estimates. Its reward was up 8.5%. After seeing same-store sales fall, yeah, you say that 10 times fast. Staples forecast lower profits than expected, got scissored 7% today. Another big box chain under pressure, Best Buy, added nearly 2% after a buy recommendation today. TripAdvisor, the travel information website, booked a 2% increase after its outlook was raised. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.94%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department is scheduled to release revised productivity data for the fourth quarter. Chain stores are slated to report February sales. And you have one more day to pen a thank you for National Write a Letter of Appreciation Week. But you're so on top of things, you've probably already done it. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's big news out of the Burlington Northern and Santa Fe today. Yeah, we're talking trains here, people. BNSF Railways, the second biggest rail freight network in the country, is going to do a little experiment. Switch some of its locomotives from diesel to natural gas. Now, there is a little bit of corporate synergy going on here. BNSF happens to be owned by the train-loving oracle of Omaha himself, Warren Buffett, who, lo and behold, has made some big investments in natural gas. But be that as it may, if this experiment catches on, it could mean big profits and big changes for the railroad business, as Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
BNSF considered using natural gas in its locomotives back in the 80s, but there's a big difference between then and now. Natural gas is way cheaper than diesel today.
Something has to take advantage of that economic arbitrage.
David Bellman is an energy consultant who points out that BNSF is doing exactly that, taking advantage of the low cost of natural gas. But the transition won't be simple. Locomotives will have to be redesigned. They will need more fuel storage and new fueling stations. All that infrastructure is going to be expensive. But according to energy expert Amy Jaffe, it's worth it for Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway.
You can make money almost overnight, even including the costs of the conversion of the vehicles.
Once the conversion is complete, BNSF trains will have to refuel less often than diesel trains. They'll be cheaper to run and pollute less.
I would expect that more than one railroad will definitely do this.
That could put the entire railroad industry on a new track. Companies like GE and Caterpillar, which are designing the new liquid natural gas locomotives, would also benefit from the conversion. And it could spread to gas suppliers.
You have some very big players. Shell has entered this market. BP is looking at this market. ConocoPhillips.
Of course, all that demand for natural gas will make the price go up. That could reduce some of its advantage over diesel. But most analysts expect natural gas to stay below the cost of diesel for quite a while. And a rise in demand, coupled with a little price increase, probably wouldn't bother Warren Buffett, who's invested billions in natural gas. In the end, he could make out like a train bandit. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
In other news, Martha Stewart, it turns out, has a sense of humor. Ms. Stewart spent the better part of yesterday in court testifying in a lawsuit that Macy's has filed against her company, about which I'll tell you more in just a second. But at one point on the witness stand, she was asked how she spends her time each day. And without missing a beat, she said, "Oh, I did my time." It was, in fact, 5 months for conspiracy and obstruction of justice back in 2004. But the present case is more mundane. Macy's said Stewart violated an exclusivity agreement when she signed a deal to sell products through rival JCPenney. And at the heart of it is this seemingly but not really obvious question. What is a store? Sally Herships has that story.
It sounds like a question for the King Solomon of retail. Is a store within a store a separate store? JCPenney plans to sell Martha Stewart products in Martha Stewart stores within the department store. Stewart says that's allowed under her deal with Macy's. Let's start with a simple definition.
A store is a marketplace of goods and services and experiences.
Nancy Kane is a retail historian at Harvard.
And that has been true since Laura Ingalls Wilder's father, Paul, was buying Calico and Lemon Drops.
But fast forward 150 years, and we've gone from Little House on the Prairie to the Clinique counter, which Kane says, from the business owner's perspective, is a separate store within a store. The staff behind the counter is often hired and trained by the brand. But what about the consumer perspective?
Do they think about it as, well, actually, I'm buying Martha Stewart at JCPenney?
Wendy Liebman is CEO of WSL Strategic Retail.
Or do they think about it as, oh, I'm going to Martha Stewart?
Liebman says, consider what shoppers have told her company about Sephora Cosmetics, another brand sold at JCPenney.
And what's pretty clear to people who shop the Sephora in JCPenney is that they are actually going to a Sephora store. And most people, while they know they're in JCPenney buying it, will actually say, oh, no, I'm going to Sephora.
To answer the question, what is a store? Effectively, it may be better to ask consumers than a judge. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
I went to the office fridge at lunchtime today here at Marketplace World Headquarters, opened the door expecting to be able to grab my Greek yogurt and be on my merry way. And I honestly couldn't find mine for all the Greek yogurts that were in there. Chobani, Oikos, the Trader Joe's house brand, there were a whole bunch anyway. And really, what's up with that? I mean, yogurt's been kind of big here for a good long while. We know that. And the Greeks have been making theirs for centuries, probably. But what happened that Greek yogurt is now the new thing? How, for that matter, does anything become a trend? Jonah Berger asks and answers that question in his new book. It's called Contagious, Why Things Catch On. Jonah, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So listen, that Greek yogurt thing in the fridge was real, man. What I mean, how does, just for an example, Greek yogurt or frankly anything become this craze?
Greek yogurt is a great example. 5 years ago, very few people had heard of the product outside of Greece probably. And now it's something that we can't get away from, right? There's almost a whole half of an aisle devoted to Greek yogurt. And it's really a great example of the power of social influence and word of mouth. They did spend some money in advertising, but it's really people trying the product and telling others how fantastic it was.
Well, what makes it sing, right? Is it a psychological thing? Is it neurobiological? Is it wanting to keep up with the Joneses? I mean,
some of it is keeping up with the Joneses, talking about things that make us look good rather than bad, you know, smart and in the know rather than dumb and behind the times. But there's also some other factors at work. So we tend to talk about things that are top of mind, even things that are not the most interesting. Why do we always talk about the weather or what we're doing this weekend? It's because it's top of mind. It's triggered by the environment, and we want to have something to say rather than nothing.
So here's another one, and you talk about this in the book. The idea in this day and age of most emailed lists, whether it's on the New York Times homepage or at marketplace.org.
We actually looked at over 6 months of articles, what goes viral. Sure enough, positive things are shared more than negative ones. But actually, even some negative emotions are highly shared if they're arousing. Things like anger or anxiety, for example, those are negative states. They don't really feel good, but they activate us. They make our pulse quicken. They make us want to get up out of our chairs and do something. And so these high arousal emotions, whether they're negative, like anger and anxiety, or positive, like excitement or even amusement, increase sharing. And so I think this is sort of neat because it helps us explain both why YouTube videos go viral, which are pretty funny, and why angry political rants go viral.
I want to bring up a cultural thing, a happening really, that I thankfully missed until it was out of the zeitgeist and so have been able to ignore. But you actually mentioned it a little bit in this book. Who was that girl? Rebecca Black and that song, Friday?
Rebecca Black is a great example.
I mean, everyone listens to that song. That thing went, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it was one of the most viral videos of 2011 and even into 2012. But the funny thing was that everybody hated that song.
Yeah.
And so it was really puzzling, right? If it's so bad, why are so many people sharing
it? Right.
But with the help of some nice data from YouTube, what we found is there's actually a pretty interesting driver. It's not random or luck why that song caught on. So if you look at the data, every certain day of the week, there are more people searching for that song. And if you look at it, there's a spike every 7 days. So 7 days, there'll be a spike. Another 7 days, another spike in the number of searches for the video. And in fact, it's every Friday. Even though that song is equally bad every single day of the week, Friday is a ready reminder, what we call a trigger, to encourage people to think about that song, to make it top of mind, and to share it with others.
All right. So you know what that makes me think is that human beings are just lemmings following the herd. We're just suckers and we do what everybody else does.
Well, that's one way to frame it, Kai. I think it is. And you know, first of all, we don't like to think of ourselves as lemmings. We like to think of ourselves as unique, special snowflakes. Each one of us is different from our neighbors and friends. But at the same time, following others often helps us out, right? It helps us figure out where's a good restaurant to eat. Well, if it's full, it's probably a good place to go. And so we use the fact that other people are there as a signal of quality, for example. So following the herd seems like a bad thing, but it often actually helps us out.
Jonah Berger, he teaches marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and he has a new book. It's called Contagious: Why Things Catch On. Jonah, thanks a bunch.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This fun on the... on the way out... damn you, Dubner. All right, I'll think of something new, I guess. But meanwhile, in the interest of equal time, this press release today from the Speaker of the House, John Boehner. While I'm disappointed the White House has chosen to comply with sequestration by cutting public tours, Boehner says, I am pleased to assure you that public tours of the United States Capitol will continue, as will, I'm sure, the sequestration tit for tat. That last bit, that was me, not the Speaker. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow added 42 points, 0.3%. Trying to make it 3 tomorrow, huh, guys? All right, the NASDAQ was flat off a point. The S&P 500 gained a point, 0.1%. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carmen, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.